Okay.
So let's remember again, notice, I'm still alive. And then notice our response, kind of like, yeah, then, which implies we think we're permanent, straight away, right there, it proves it. So think like you're in your car and the petrol gauge doesn't work. Look at the sense of urgency you'd have, in trepidation every time you turn on the engine, and you can't believe it still goes. You can't believe there's petrol still there. You can't believe it. Every time you turn on the engine, you can't believe it's still going. You can't believe it. That's how we should think. But it's like you forget there's a petrol tank, and you forget that it uses petrol when you drive, so you just think it's going to last for eternity. That's how stupid we are. That's grasping it as permanent, unchanging. Forever, because I'm existing today, I'm assuming I'll exist forever. It's very foolish. So be amazed you wake up in the morning. Still petrol in the tank. How incredible. And that petrol is our past virtue, past non-killing. Practice in the context of vows of non-killing. Practice in the context of a spiritual path. It would blow our minds if we remembered how much we worked just to have this life. So what's the conclusion? Don't waste it. That's why we're here. Listening, thinking, analysing, seeing if there's some tools we can take from this advice from the Buddha to use in our life to develop our amazing potential. For our sake, absolutely for our sake. And so then for the sake of others. Thinking like that. And the first two lines just of the prayer reminding us of our reliance on the Buddha and his teachings. That's it. Sangye charang soke chognam la changchu badu dagni kyabsu chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la changchu badu dagni kyabsu chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki drola penchir sangye drupa shog sangye charang soke chognam la changchu Badu dagni kyapsu chi dagi chanyen gipe sonam ki rola penchir sangye drupa shok. So let's do a little meditation. Blessing the speech. I love this meditation. Can we find it in our prayer books? Yeah? It's in there. Oh, brilliant. Tell them where to look. Now, actually, all you need, I'm going to guide you in the meditation, but all you need is to see where the mantras are. What we're going to do is, it's a little meditation of visualization, and what we're going to recite is actually the Sanskrit alphabet, which sounds hilarious, doesn't it? But these sounds are said to be totally pure and holy and profound. So by reciting, as you see, we're going to recite the vowels, then the consonants, and then the dependent arising heart mantra, which is going to purify body, speech, and mind. You'll see in this different visualizations, there's variations of the same theme, always visualizing body, purifying body, speech, and mind. It's a very nice little meditation. And then it's also in your prayer book. So tell them the page, Sashi. Tell the page for the people in the prayer book. Tell the people. Page.
Page 15, back.
It's in either book. The main thing is just go to the page where the mantras are. 17. Okay. And so the rest of it, you just close your eyes and imagine. Use all these visualization meditations are using our creative imagination. Think like that. And we're very good at that. We say, oh, I can't visualize. I mean, don't be absurd. We spend all day visualizing. We visualize the people we can't stand. We think of every possible quality about them, single-pointedly. You can be in the middle of the football field. You won't say to the people, be quiet, I'm trying to visualize. No, you can do it single-pointedly because it's anger. Single-pointedly on attachment. We're very good at it. So here we're trying to use it for virtue, which is kind of boring, isn't it? That's why we get distracted. So we have to practice. And remember, every thought counts. There is no thought that goes astray. Every thought is sowing a seed. This is kind of intense. When we really begin to understand karma, we're going to watch our mind like a hawk. Of course we would. Who'd want to sow a poison seed in your garden? Nobody. So this is why we have to have a sense of self-respect. This is for us. Not just to be good girls and boys so we get praised and not punished. That's the childish way of seeing morality. Okay. So a little refuge prayer. You can read that if you like, right there at the beginning. A little tiny one. So cute. I take refuge in the three jewels. May I become a Buddha to benefit all. I take refuge in the three jewels. May I become a Buddha to benefit all. I take refuge in the three jewels. May I become Buddha to benefit all. So now, if you've taken initiation, you visualize, you manifest out of emptiness as the deity. And if not, you just visualize Buddha above your head. Do your best. Just imagine the enlightened energy, blissful light energy above your crown, the Buddha. So now, you imagine on your tongue is the syllable R. Obviously, we don't know Tibetan or Sanskrit, so just the letter, you know, in Roman letters, R, standing upright. It transforms, this syllable now turns into a moon disc. The R on your tongue turns into a moon disc, like a flat white cushion on your tongue. So on top of the white moon disc, there now appears a white om, just standing upright in the center. Om. And now imagine it is surrounded by all the white vowels. Obviously, we don't know these, so we just have to pretend. All the white Sanskrit vowels going clockwise on our tongue. And surrounding the vowels are the red consonants, counterclockwise, anticlockwise. and surrounding the consonants, first the vowels, white, then the red consonants, and now surrounding them, the blue, Rinpoche calls it the heart mantra of dependent relation, or it's the mantra of dependent arising. Blue, sort of darkish blue letters, like the sky, blue, clockwise around that, all standing upright on your tongue. So now, you imagine, light beams go out from all these syllables, all these letters on your tongue, into all the 10 directions, up, down, left, right, you know, northeast, northwest, everywhere, all the, sending this powerful light out. And what it does is hook the blessings and all the power and all the energy of all the of the mundane and supramundane, the power of the speech of all the Buddhas, all the bodhisattvas, all the yogis, all the holy beings, and even all just people practicing virtue, the power of this speech. They talk about the power of speech of the Buddha. That's his main gift, the power of speech. So hooking this energy from all directions, imagine. And all comes back, all this from all the 10 directions, these beams with this energy of the power of speech comes back and enters into all your syllables, making them radiant and powerful. And powerful with the energy of all the holy speech of all the beings of the universe. Imagine this. These are people who have, Rinpoche says, who have actualized the words of truth, who have great power in their speech, such that any sound they utter benefits whoever hears it. And this is gained from, first, from silence, second, from not saying negative words, and then, of course, from practicing virtue and from saying mantra. This is what gives us the power of speech. Unbelievable. We need this badly. In our own lives, we need this. Think about it. We have to say what we want in a shop. We have to tell our children what to do. We have to have people at work trust our words. This is one of our worst pains when people don't. Because we don't have the power of speech. This is an incredibly necessary quality. So now, as we recite the vowels, we visualize white nectar pouring down from these letters and filling our entire body, totally purifying every atom of all the negative karma we've ever created since beginningless time with our bodies. As we recite these Sanskrit mantras, we do together, okay? They're very simple. Om, ah, have you got it? Make sure you've got it. Om, ah, ah, ee, ee, oo, oo, ri, ri, li, li, e, au, ah, ang, ah. Om, ah, 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 svaha. Om, ah, ah, ee, ee, oo, oo, ri, ri, li, li, e, o, au, ang, ah, svaha. Om, ah, ah, ee, ee, oo, oo, ri, ri, li, li, e, o, au, ang, ah, svaha. Full of this nectar. Purifying all the negative karma of body. Blissful, radiant, full of nectar. Now we recite the consonants, and from the red consonants on our tongue, red nectar pours down and up and fills our entire body, and this time purifying all of our ridiculous speech since beginningless time. And this means the actual words that are completely wrong, lies. But let's think about it. We also speculate. We always want to be right, and we're the first. We're always giving our opinions. And we half the time we're not even right. Half the time we don't even know what we're saying is accurate. But we mislead people. It's so incredible, and it's so ignorant. We don't even realize we're not speaking the truth. Most of the time we do this because we're so eager to be seen to know what we're talking about. So all that speculating, all of this endless rabbiting on, useless talk that exhausts people, all the abuse, harsh language to people's faces,
And especially, I think, all the talking behind people's backs. We love to find fault. We cannot wait to talk about bad things about people behind their backs. All of this negative speech. Totally purified by this blissful, powerful red nectar filling us as we recite the syllables. Om ka 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 ga nga cha 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 nya ta 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 da na ta 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 da na pa pa ba ba ma ya ra la va sha sa sa ha sa swaha. Om ka 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 ga nga cha 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 ja nya ta 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 da na ta 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 da na pa 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 ba ma ya ra la va sha sa sa ha sa swaha. Om ka 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 ga nga cha 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 ja nya cha 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 da na cha 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 da na pa 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 ba ma ya ra la va sha sha sa ha sha swaha. Full of this blissful red nectar, all our speech totally purified. How wonderful. And now as we recite the heart mantra of dependent relation, as Rinpoche calls it, we visualize this blue nectar pouring from the letters, filling us completely. And this time, of course, purifying our mind, which is the source of all the problems, especially the ignorance, the root misconception, the root mental illness, the root mental affliction, the root disturbing emotion, the most primordial, this primordial mistaken sense of me. It's the source of all the others. And then the attachment to get what that fantasy me wants. Then the drama and fear and panic and anger and despair and depression and guilt and frustration and annoyance and irritation when it doesn't get what it wants. Then all the other rubbish as a result. Low self-esteem, arrogance, jealousy, all this stuff. All of this that breaks our hearts and causes us to be harmful to others. All of this instantly purified as we recite this mantra. Om ye dama hetu pabawa hetun teshan tatagato ye vedat teshan chayo nirora evamba di maha shamanaye svaha. Om ye dama hetu pabawa hetun teshan tatagato ye vedat teshan chayo nirora evamba di maha shamanaye svaha. Om ye dama hetu pabawa hetun teshan tatagato ye vedat teshan chayo niroda evam vadi maha shamanaye svaha. Full of this radiant blue nectar, completely purified our ridiculous mind, making it blissful, radiant, clear, vast, in touch with reality, its true nature. How marvelous. So now we imagine the blue heart mantra of dependent relation dissolves into the red consonants on our tongue. The red consonants dissolve into the white vowels. The white vowels dissolve into the white om. The white om dissolves into the white moon disk. And the moon disk turns into an R. And now the R transforms into pink-coloured nectar and dissolves into our tongue. We imagine our tongue becomes indestructible. Rinpoche says, imagine your tongue is like very heavy and strong, as if difficult to move, and as indestructible as a vajra. Nothing can harm or take away or destroy the power of our speech, the power of our mantra. Have such confidence that now all the power and blessings of the speech of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and sages and yogis have entered your speech and that your speech is perfected. Think, I have perfected my speech. And think, the minute that sentient beings hear you, it immediately pacifies all their emotional problems. Imagine this. And everything you wish becomes fulfilled. Whatever you say will be fulfilled. And not to mention, people will believe you. People will trust your words. People will do what you want. This is profound. Speech is our main tool. We must use it. And this is the way to benefit sentient beings. It's the main gift of the Buddha. You could see a million Buddhas a day looking at you, very handsome. If they don't open their mouth and give you advice, what good are they? Speech is incredible. So now this sweet little dedication. Say it together. Tell them the page. Wherever you're looking. It's the most unlikely little prayer. It's so sweet. Say it together. Got the pages? Got it? Yeah? Say it together. Say it together, loud and strong. Okay. May my tongue have all the courage of the ones gone to bliss. By the power manifesting from these glorified words, may all sentient beings be subdued. And whatever words I say, may all these actions be accomplished instantly. Isn't that nice? I love this practice. I think it's the cutest practice. Who would have thought to, may my tongue, you know, have the courage? It's so sweet. But look how important speech is, you know. It's so powerful. I mean, it's like we all hear this from the beginning. When we first become Buddhists, yeah, control your body, control your speech. It's taken me 43 years to hear it. Just now I get excited about it. 43 years later. It takes time. Well, if you're slow like me, it takes time. Maybe you guys have got it immediately. Speech is, you know, in Buddha's instructions, at the very first level, before you even take vows, he exhorts us to control our speech, not to say bad things behind backs. Then in the Bodhisattva vows, there's a vow. In the tantric vows, there's a vow. So when you see schisms in organizations, in families, in Buddhist organizations, in countries, it's because of speech. There's this huge schism in one of our centres in the early 80s in England. I was part of it. It was like a war zone. It was like being in a war zone. I'll never forget it. It was so painful. And Lama Zopa told us at the time, this is the result of breaking our third root tantric vow, which says, as Lama Zopa translates it, speaking the faults of your Vajra brothers and sisters from past lives. So look at the Gelugpas, you know, there's now all the practitioners of Shugden. You go to Indian monasteries now, and Gandhin Monastery, Lama Tsongkhapa's first monastery, is cut in half, like a Berlin Wall. Disharmony. The two Karmapas, at least they're talking to each other now. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? That's incredible, isn't it? They've met and they're trying to be working together. That's miraculous. Oh, that was incredible, I thought. That's good. They're healing the drama. But it's all disharmony from our own past lives, because whatever we see is our own karmic appearance. It's our karmic appearance. We created it. So this war zone that was in the centre of early 80s. I'll never forget it. And all this is what you think about family. Do you think about your partner? You know, we don't understand what happened. We kept thinking, well, suddenly we're becoming divorced and you hate each other and these dramas. And you keep thinking, what did I do wrong? And you can't find anything because half the time it's past karma, like vomit ripening. The person just emailed me recently in despair. over the, suddenly this husband, she thought she had the best marriage in the universe. Loving, compassionate, he adored her every day. He'd ring her, talk to her, text her. Two beautiful children. She, you know, lent all this money to him and helped his education. And suddenly he's turned against her, hates her, abuses her, insults her, divorced her, has all these girlfriends, blames her for everything. She keeps thinking, what have I done wrong? Well, nothing. It's past karma vomiting forth. That's why we have to purify. And control our speech. Most of us don't go around raping and killing, it's clear. We're nice people. We don't think speech is important in our culture. We can say what we like, we say. We think it doesn't have consequences. That's the meaning. That's the ignorance of our mind. That's what karma means. Everything has consequences. That's as ignorant, as stupid, as saying, I can eat what I like, as if it has no consequences in your body, whereas we know a body is the total of the food you put in it. Well, your mind, the person you become, is the result of what you put in your mind and what you say and do. We are the creators of ourselves. That's the meaning of karma. It's utterly kind of integrated. It's utterly internal. It's utterly kind of... It's non-dualistic. So out of self-respect, out of kindness to ourselves. We talk about being kind to ourselves. We think it means going and having a massage. Have a massage. I love a massage. That is being kind. But the real kindness is practicing virtue. That's what the joke is. But the trouble is, Tibetans always sound so fundamentalist. When you read how they talk, that's no wonder Matt thinks it's all judgmental. Tibetans are the heaviest way they talk. It's unbelievable. They're worse than the Baptists and the fundamentalists and the communists. How they talk is very hilarious, isn't it? They're so fundamentalist, the way they talk. It's hilarious. That's why Lama Yeshe was like bliss for our ears. You know, he talked just like we did, like a hippie. It was amazing. So sweet. Made you feel good. Speech. Incredible. And think of your life. Everybody needs speech. The pain we have when people don't believe us or don't trust our words, don't value our words. Unbearable. It's like you're talking in the air and no one listens, you know. You can't believe it. So you have to purify it. Make it powerful. Silence. Don't say stupid words. Keep your mouth shut. And say mantra. This is the thing that's so fascinating. I find this very helpful. This is from the Vajrayana model of how things work. And it's very helpful to understand even the way karma works, but understand the speech one. It's very powerful, even our mind. Lama Zopa says, in the Kala Chakra Tantra, as we know, the word tantra refers both to a type of practice, but also to the texts. So in the Kala Chakra Tantra, Rumite said, I remember reading somewhere, there are these detailed descriptions of the intimate relationship between internal and external energy. So internal is the mind, thoughts. External is the physical energy. So we have, like we talked, gross consciousness and gross body. This is the body, gross body. But we have subtle body. The 72,000 subtle channels coursing through our body. This is the same as the Hindus, the same as the Chinese, a variation of it, you know. A nervous system of 72,000 subtle channels pervading our body and coursing through those channels this wind energy, prana. This is the basis of the health system in the Tibetan medical system. They study this for 7, 10, 12 years. All these different wind energies is the source of our health. And this is the point that's fascinating in the Vajrayana. All sentient beings in the universe, all minds, all consciousnesses are inextricably linked to their own set of the four elements. This is just the way things are. It's just the way things are. No one made it this way. It has been observed by the holy beings. The universe consists of matter, which is the four elements, and mind. That's it. Speaking simply. And all minds are inextricably linked to their own set of the four elements. And this is the point now, as Lama Zopa said, for example, let's say if you get angry, just your mind, forget your speech, just your mind is angry. What that does automatically is pollute the wind energies that your anger is connected with. Eventually, karmically, that continues to imprint on your mind, anger, and it continues to pollute your wind energies, which eventually karmically manifest as sickness. You create your own sickness, not in this life, next life, this life as well, but really it's next life. And then in turn, more powerfully over a much longer period, that anger which impacts upon your winds eventually impacts upon the external elements, and that is what creates the imbalance of the external elements, the disharmony of the elements. So that'll manifest as environmental karma. You know, say for example, killing. Killing would manifest as a habit to kill. Killing would manifest as an experience where you get killed. And killing will manifest as having an environment that's polluted and disgusting and harms you. All this created by minds because of this relationship between the wind energies, the four elements, and the mind, you know. This is the observation of the great beings. This is the model. So, for our own benefit, this is the point to see. Not some judgmental, moralistic reason not to be angry, not to be depressed, not to be jealous. Don't feel guilty. We're all in this. We've all got it. So that's why we wish to practice it, so we can heal our precious minds. Stop the suffering. It's in our hands. And then speech, even more powerful, obviously. Speech, according to Tantra, it's obvious. Speech is mantra. When we purify it, it is mantra. Speech is the wind energy. That is what speech is. If there's no air, there's no sound, is there? So the wind energy is speech. We want to try and purify it to become powerful speech, mantra. But we think speech doesn't matter. We think mind doesn't matter. It's unbelievable how ignorant we are. I can think what I like. I can say what I like, we say, which implies we think there's no cause and effect. There's no consequences to oneself. There's no result. One time in my computer years ago, my iPad in the New York Times, I saw a story, I always quote this story, of one woman in Brooklyn who went into her husband's computer and discovered that he was part of a cannibal site and they were planning to kill and eat her. She was quite shocked. She didn't just call the police. She called the FBI. That's hilarious, isn't it? So the point is, his defense lawyers, and the lawyers are meant to be intelligent people, their position, their defense was, oh, he's allowed to think what he likes. It doesn't mean he's going to do it. I mean, we really believe, and we think of our mind as a special kind of special cave in there that's very secret. We have all these fantasies. We're allowed to have all these berserk thoughts, you know, having sex with 42 people or killing and lying or doing all kinds of things or taking things. We think it's like we're allowed to do that, as if we're supposed to be given permission, you know. It's my secret mind. As long as no one knows, it doesn't matter. And Buddha's whole point is, whatever you do with your body and speech, baby, guess where it comes from? Your mind. I mean, like, duh. We are so mad, you know, so unintelligent, with respect. We are convinced it comes from outside. I'm convinced it's all Ron who does it to me. I'm this innocent victim. That's how demented we are. Speech, anyway, blah, blah. And it's somehow so obvious the benefit to yourself. Forget other people. Yourself. One day. But meditating is hard. Controlling your mind is almost impossible, as we've discussed. But look at how hard it is to control our speech. Even our hand, you say, I'm going to go on a diet. I'll go on a diet, one piece of cake. I'll only have one piece of cake. You finish it, I'll only have one piece of cake. Oh, what's happened? Eating a second piece of cake. Almost like you did, you know, a separate person inside you did it. We can see how hard our poor old body and speech are to control. This is why it's the first level of practice, ground level, discipline. So, you know, just because you maybe have a fantasy, let's say you like to think about sex or watch the porn videos. I'm not complaining. I mean, everyone does everything. It doesn't matter. Let's say we've got, you know, I'm attached to my iPad. Believe me. If it doesn't work, if I don't have Wi-Fi, I have a panic attack. Okay, I need it for my work, but also, you know, reading all my newspapers and magazines. You can tell I'm old. I never look at social media. I read newspapers and magazines. That's what old people do. So, I was going to say something and I forgot. Distracted myself. What was I about to say? I forget. Control, yeah, what? What happened? What'd you say? Oh, Tiziana knows. What did he say? Who said something, Tiziana? What happened?
They said people watching.
Thank you. Tell us what happened. Oh, the porn. Oh, thank you very much. The porn. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So say you like watching porn, you know? Yeah, I said that, but why am I saying it? I forget. I forget why I'm saying it. What am I thinking?
I think you were talking about thinking inside and thinking that this doesn't hurt.
It doesn't matter, it doesn't hurt, yeah.
It doesn't matter, and doing some act without...
Oh, yeah, without control, all of that. Yeah, but there was a particular... I know, but I've just forgot that little piece in there. But there is something to say. It's interesting. This is where if we understand the different levels of practice implied in this Lamrim. First level, junior school, entry level, first level, ground level, foundation level. Harness the energy of our body and speech, which means at the very least... attempt not to do actions with them that harm others. That's the first level of practice. Oh, yeah, I get the point I was going to say now. At least that. At least that. Why? Because they're the heaviest ones, because they harm others. Most things we do that are, many things we do that are driven by delusions only harm us. All the eating too much, all the fantasies, all the dramas, all the shouting and yelling when no one else hears us, that harms us. But this is at least stop the actions that harm others, which bring the dire results in the future. At least that is the first level. But then we can get the message from that. We get the idea. We don't go, oh, well, Buddha says I shouldn't jump on more than somebody else's girl, but I'm allowed to eat 47 pieces of cake. Buddha doesn't say, oh, you're not allowed to watch videos of sex. So you think, oh, I can do that. Like, that's a baby of you. I'm allowed to. Allowed to is meaningless. No one's bossing you around. Buddha's advising us based on his own observation. So what I'm saying is, attachment is attachment is attachment. Whether the object of your attachment is cake, whether the object is killing fish, for example, that's driven by attachment. Whether it's to steal or whether it's to watch porn videos. Attachment is attachment, but some of the objects of that attachment are more heavy than others, especially if they harm others. Some actions we do based on attachment harm us more than others. I mean, physically, for sure, food will harm you. You know, watching porn videos won't harm you physically. You'll still stay fit. You'll still go to the gym and look gorgeous. But the point I'm making is this. We can see from the Buddha's teachings, he's advising us to not do certain actions that harm others, which are actions that are driven by the disturbing emotions, mainly anger and attachment. So because attachment is attachment is attachment, if you can control yourself by not jumping on more than one girl a day or not jumping on the wrong girl, let's say someone else's, you can be very virtuous about that, but you stuff yourself with cake all day. Well, that doesn't help you. Because you're feeding attachment, and the attachment's the problem. So when you can see that by controlling attachment in relation to one action, it helps your attachment in relation to everything. So it's schizophrenic to think that you're allowed to eat cake, but you're not allowed to watch porn. Allowed has got nothing to do with it, but attachment will be fed one way or the other. So the bottom line is we're trying to contain our energy and calm our attachment down. Of course, this is hard work. And that's where if we hear it as judgment, we hear it as moralistic, and we get guilty, we're just making ourselves more neurotic. That is not spiritual practice. So the very first level of practice, there's no wiggle room. You just try to do your best to harness your energy of your body and your speech, and then in high school, of your mind. Okay, Buddha does talk about the mind in junior school. There's a list of 10 don'ts. The first three are the body, next four are the speech, and then it's sort of the way I like to say it, is just he gets us to at least harness, attempt to control the very heavy-duty levels of the three toxic emotions. So the first one is called craving. It's like this extra heavy level of attachment. Think about it. And you can see the suffering for some people, so intense. When it becomes intense craving for sex all day, intense craving for food, intense craving for money, you can see it in some much more powerful attachment where you're constantly in such pain, never stopping craving. And you can see it's an absolute nightmare. It's very obvious. At least try and harness that level of attachment. Then the anger, they call it ill will. I mean, such a silly, simple little term. But think about this and look at the world. We get angry, but when we let it go. Well, the people who can't let it go and never stop being angry, and then it leads to wanting the other people to suffer. That's the heavy-duty level of anger. And you can see the evidence in the world. It's unbelievably powerful. Ill will, malice, so heavy, based on anger. And then to try and harness and control the one particular aspect of ego grasping, the root delusion, ignorance. So one aspect, one heavy aspect of very strong ego grasping is just stupidity, ignorant, really narrow-minded, fundamentalist mind. Eye for an eye, racist, sexist, no, fundamentalist in whatever form. And that's a very common thing for all of us. I'm right, you're wrong. That's fundamentalism. And that's a rigid mind with no space, no dependent arising. That at least attempt to control. They call it wrong view. This is so obvious. This is the first level of practice, already profound. It's like a joke to think that we can start to meditate if we don't do that, and that's just high school. And it's a complete joke to think we can really practice valid compassion if we haven't done that. And it's a complete hysterical, demented joke to think that you can even begin to understand, not mention practice, Tantra, without this. Just pathetic, arrogant, foolish, idiotic, unintelligent, stupid. Harmful to ourselves. So let's carry on with the heavy-duty practices of the eight verses. So the summary of them. The first one, broadest view possible. You want to make the most of all these suffering sentient beings because they are the grist for your mill. For you to smash your ego grasping and self-cherishing so you can become a Buddha, so you can benefit all of them. That's the general first one. So there's an action point in each one. The action point. Who translated this one? This is rubbish. Who's this translation? I don't want that one. That's nonsense. I don't know who did it. I'd rather have Lama's Opus. I mean, so if I know anything, I don't even speak Tibetan, so excuse me. I'm so arrogant. Please forgive me. Wow. Amazing. Who translated this? It doesn't say. Oh, yes, it does. I better not be careful. I better be careful who I criticize. Oh, I'm criticizing Geshe Thupten Jinpa, Dalai Lama's translator. See, I'm such a smarty pants, aren't I?
Yeah,
Okay, never mind. I'll read it again. I'm just used to Lama Zopa's translation, that's all. Yes, right, it's perfect. I mean, who am I? I mean, excuse me. I know Geshe Lama Lunjup, the abbot at Kopan, would always make me feel so ashamed because he knows perfectly well, he knew, he's dead now, he knew I never spoke Tibetan. I never bothered. I was lazy. I just didn't do it. And he always spoke to me in Tibetan, always to embarrass me, you know. I was always embarrassed. I couldn't even better go to see him. I knew he'd speak to me in Tibetan. So they say, it's a wonderful practice. If you're feeling depressed, a really good practice is to think of something you can do. Lift yourself up. If you're feeling arrogant, think of something you can't do. Well, every time I feel arrogant, which is most of the time, I just have to remember I don't speak anything but Australian. I mean, I come here and Siliana has to translate for me. I go to France and Francois translates. Everywhere I go, people have to speak my ridiculous words because I'm so lazy, I've not learned another language. You know, look, I know Tiziana, I know this one, Ioana from Romania, she speaks perfect English. What else do you speak? Other languages? No. Romanian, probably. French, she speaks French. What else? There you go, you see. I mean, other you people as well. I mean, some Dutch people speak about 6 languages. They're incredible, the Dutchies. How many? You see? And I speak Australian. I mean, so straight away, I don't humble, but I try to feel humble. He says it very differently anyway. Never mind, I'll use Lama Zopa's translation. I like Lama Zopa's best. So the essence of it, like I said, the first one, is this idea that if you want to become a Buddha, like if you want to become a doctor, you've got to have suffering people. That's the point. If you want to become a surgeon, you've got to meet people who are suffering, don't you? Think about the meaning. You've got to meet suffering people. And the more suffering, the better for you. Because it'll test your skills to the limit and you'll quickly become the best doctor and then you're qualified to benefit as many people as possible. That's the meaning of relying upon sentient beings. It's an odd concept, but when you understand that, you get it. So we can see this attitude of a bodhisattva is pretty brave. Our first instinct is to keep away from sentient beings. We can't cope with them. We don't like them. We don't like them being in the centres because, you know, don't like all those people. They're all this and all these weird people. I'd rather on my own. I mean, I'm like that. I'm completely self-centred. Can you imagine if I lived in a nunnery? I'd have to make me the dishwasher, I think, and to shut my mouth all day. Then I'd be okay. But bodhisattvas need to be around the crazies, the psychopaths, the pedophiles. I mean it, you know, because that's grist for their mill. Because every time you meet a crazy person, like it says in verse 3 or something, like you've met a precious treasure, because it's forcing you to go beyond your self-cherishing, forcing you to have compassion. It's like Lance Armstrong going up the mountains. It stretches him to the limit. That's the attitude of the bodhisattvas. They're like, talk about middle way, you know, Will thinking, Matt thinking it's all about balance. Rubbish. The bodhisattvas are fanatics, Matt. What? What? Oh, Max, sorry, Max. They're fanatics, dear. Fanatics, Max. Look at Lama Zopa, he's a maniac. He's a fanatic. Since his stroke, he screams. He never screamed before. Now he screams all the time. Don't misunderstand me. Shouts. I sort of feel since his stroke, he's kind of increased his bodhicitta and emptiness about a billion times or something. You know, his enthusiasm. Dalai Lama, you look at him. When you hear him teaching, he talks so fast and shout. He shouts as well. I have good examples. Great relief. The next one is, the shocking one, to attempt to practice seeing yourself as low, as inferior, and others as superior. This is very, very, very bizarre in our culture. We really have to interpret this appropriately, and we really have to know if we are capable, because it's a very high practice. Because most of the time, because of our attachment, and because we have pride, let's talk about this a bit now. Let's talk about, go back to high school and look at the mind, you know. This is a very, very sobering idea. The commonest one we all recognize in our culture, the pain we experience, is what we call low self-esteem. We loathe ourselves. We love to loathe. I'm not being horrible. It's common in all cultures. We have a lot of unhappiness about ourselves. We think we are not good. We believe the bad stories, you know. Low self-esteem. So let's analyze it. First of all, this ego grasping. That's the colloquial term for the root delusion, the root misconception, this primordial source of all suffering in the universe since beginningless time. The misconception of an intrinsic me. On the basis of that, there's this immense emotional hunger, this deep primordial dissatisfaction that I am therefore not enough, this separate, lonely, bereft me, never enough, I'm not enough, what I get is not enough, how much Ron says he loves me, not enough, how thin I get, not enough. I mean, just this never-ending bottomless pit of dissatisfaction. As Rinpoche says, that's the main suffering in the West. And this is from practicing attachment in past lives, that we come in with this residual result of it. Then we're constantly craving to find something to fill up that hole, to bring satisfaction. Which is this vampire-ness, hungry, frantic, desperate. Then, when it doesn't get what he wants, it arises as aversion. Anger, annoyed, irritated, frustrated, upset, stressed, you know, worried, depression, etc. Spectrum of thwarted attachment. They're the fundamentals. They're the three poisons. They're the root of all the others. So, and the others come from these. It's an intricate map, you know, all very integrated. So pride, which we don't like to think about, we don't think we've got pride. We might think of some people who, she's so arrogant. We can see that with some people. Overblown sense of self, it's pretty obvious. Remember the key function of all these misconceptions, these emotional, disturbing, there's billions of misconceptions in our mind. A misconception about no karma, that's a misconception. A misconception about permanence, that's a misconception. But these are the kind of emotional ones that have lots of physical energy and intensity about them. These poisons, you know. So pride, we don't like to admit to that one. We say we've got low self-esteem. Well, what we've got to comprehend is low self-esteem is deflated pride. In other words, low self-esteem is an aspect of pride. This is very embarrassing to hear it. It's hard to hear it. So when we've got low self-esteem, it's like we're seeing other people as better than us. But it's this kind of, how dare they be better than me? I should be like that. That's why we're so self-centered about it. If we didn't have pride, we would have humility. And humility is a very comfortable feeling about you're content with who you are. And then when you're humble, you delight in other people's qualities. You don't feel resentful. You don't take it personally. But if we've got pride, we're insulted by other people being better. And so instantly we turn it against ourselves. Oh, I must be bad. Because we prefer to be better. We'd prefer to be the top dog. So if we didn't have pride, we would never have low self-esteem. It's just not possible. It's impossible. It's an aspect of low self-esteem. So arrogance overstates your important qualities. And then when you meet somebody who's even better than you, you go to the other extreme and you go, oh, they're so much better than me. I'm the worst. But if you had humility, which means content with who you are, that means you're delighted in meeting somebody else who's better than you. You're not threatened by it. You delight in it. Therefore, you would never have low self-esteem. This is logical. We've got to think about it. I always use the Dalai Lama as an example. For me, if you look at the Dalai Lama, he's super charismatic, isn't he? He's powerful. You see him with people. This is now kind of me telling my Dalai Lama story. Back here in 1982, I was here with the Dalai Lama. I was part of the entourage. Lama Yeshe appointed 10 of us to be security guards. And naturally, being Lama Yeshe, he appointed 5 girls. And I was one of them. I thought I'd won the lottery. I thought I'd gone to heaven. I couldn't believe it. Me, Sylvia Wetzel. Do you ever meet Sylvia Wetzel? Me, Sylvia Wetzel. Gun from Sweden. All these, you know, and then who else? Paula was the boss. Paula de Vis was the boss. There were 5 women, 5 men. All the men were Swiss. And, four of us, 5 women, were nuns. It was curious. I'm the only nun left now. Anyway, the point was, it was an amazing experience. It blew my mind. You know, we travelled with His Holiness for like, Lama Yeshe invited His Holiness to a whole bunch of countries. To France, to Nalanda Monastery, to here, with this, when he gave Gyalwa Gyatso here, His Holiness, and he stayed in the Valletta. And I remember Lama Yeshe made us wear lay clothes. It was hilarious. We had to wear uniforms. And the boys all wore nice grey trousers and a blue blazer, a navy blue blazer, and a nice white shirt and a maroon tie. And the girls, Paula bought these in Holland. We had to wear these green tartan skirts, yellow blouse, and a maroon jacket. And I had hair at the time. I was living in London and I had hair, sort of shortish hair, you know. So I figured I better look like a proper lady. So Susanna Parodi took me to Milan to the shops and I bought these nice knee-length maroon boots. And I thought I'd better wear lipstick because ladies wear lipstick. So I walked around with lipstick and my maroon boots. I remember Lama Yeshe, he'd laugh every time he saw me. He said, "Oh, I think I like you better like that." But Geshe Rabton, when he saw me, he said, "Are you still a nun?" Anyway, why am I telling you this? His Holiness. I mean, being up close like that, I couldn't believe it, you know. I mean, we went to a few places in Spain and here and France. 6 weeks, I think, we spent flying on the aeroplane with him, guarding his hotel door, standing where there's a big tent where we had the teachers, standing there looking serious, looking out, trying to be security guards, you know. It was a joke, really. It was so kind. God. I remember that when the local Pisa police or whoever sent some security guards, these young Italians, obviously Italian, you're in Italy, these boys with their machine guns, and they stood by the Valletta looking very, this arrogant, this funny-looking fellow in the red skirt, you know, wrong kind of red skirt for him, being a Catholic. But within 3 days, he had him in the palm of their hand. You know, they just loved him, His Holiness. It was amazing to observe the way, up close, to observe how people responded to him. So what I'm getting at, he's powerful, he's charismatic, he's loud, he walks fast, he talks wise. I saw him do a press conference. He walks in and he takes over and in 3 minutes everybody does what he wants. He's the boss. And they're all kind of looking around, what happened, you know? He runs the show, there's no question. So then you think, well, a person who runs the show, who's very loud, who's charismatic, we think, oh, they must be very arrogant, you know? But no, not a shred of arrogance. We know that. I mean, I remember when he was in Australia the same one time, and I did an issue in Mandalay, a big visit in Australia, really big, to all the major cities. It was huge, you know. And I remember I did a special issue of Mandalay, and I interviewed like 50 people who'd been around the tour, media, all the people, and everybody had the same kind of response. I saw it in this country. I saw it in Spain, everywhere. That's what blew my mind. Everybody just said, you felt like you were his best friend. You knew he loved you most of all. It was immediate and obvious. So if you're arrogant, you would never feel that about a person. Not possible. But he was loud and powerful and strong and charismatic. So that for me is very consoling. You can be humble and powerful. What an amazing example. Whereas we have these wrong views. You've got to be humble, kind of all pathetic and like this, you know. That's grotesque. It's a misconception. We really don't understand these things, you know. Because our view of the mind is not so nuanced, I would suggest, as Buddha's. So you could say we confuse self-confidence with arrogance. We confuse humility with low self-esteem. Because if we can understand this view in the Buddhist psychology, that all the unhappy states of mind, all the neuroses, all the misconceptions, all the kleshas, they have this, they're eye-based. They're not other-based. They're eye-based. They're necessarily utterly self-centered, and they are utterly fear-based, and they all distort. They are all misconceptions. They all embellish. They exaggerate. That's their key function. So low self-esteem exaggerates your bad qualities. Arrogance exaggerates your good qualities. Attachment exaggerates the deliciousness of something. Anger exaggerates the ugly qualities of something. All the afflictions do that. So when we can see that in ourselves, we can distinguish between self-confidence. If you're self-confident, you'd be humble. If you're arrogant, you'd have low self-esteem. So His Holiness, there He is, powerful, charismatic. He organizes things, he takes over things. But He's unbelievably humble and unbelievably powerful at the same time. That should be very, very encouraging for us. And we can misuse this idea of being humble, and you know, we can also patience. We can completely misunderstand patience, and we can confuse it for passivity and indifference. Patience is an unbelievably powerful quality. But we think of it as passivity. Not caring, doesn't matter. Or just halt, kind of like, almost we think of it sometimes as passive aggression. You know, gushing your teeth and waiting for that ugly thing to go away. But patience is a profoundly brave state of mind. It's the exact opposite of anger. Anger is saying, how dare that happen? We're having a panic attack because attachment can't cope. But patience is this brave attitude that opens the door and you walk into the problem and you greet it happily. And when you do that, the problem dissipates. It's a very brave mind, patience. But passivity, but see, this is what's interesting. Angry people, and I know that because I'm one of those, if you can put it another way, that all these negative qualities have a good side. You can say it like that. It's not quite accurate. So I can see with my angry mind, angry people are always finding fault, aren't we? You might recognize yourself. Always finding fault. That should be this and this is this. And then if you just keep it as anger, you just go on and on and go crazy and make a mess. But if you can see the good quality in there, you can then say, what can I do to fix it? That then becomes action energy, and that's a good quality. We need that. So for a person like me, you've got to give up the angry part, the part that gets annoyed and upset and is arrogant and criticizes people, to still find fault and then say, how can I fix it? That becomes compassion. I remember Martin Luther King, blew my mind, he said that. He said, it's good to find fault. Look at the sexism, look at the racism, look at the suffering, look at the injustice. But then you say, what can I do to help? His Holiness says the same. That's what compassion is. It needs action energy. It means you've got to see problems, you've got to see faults, and then you've got to have the courage to see if you can fix it. That becomes compassion. That's powerful. But what happens if... But that's the good side of angry people. You've got to get rid of the harming part and keep the critical part and make it useful. But now, patient people are amazing people. Things don't make them crazy. It's incredible quality. But there can be the negative side there. They will put up with things they shouldn't put up with. Because you'd rather not have problems. Patient people don't like problems. They don't want to have fights. They'll do everything to avoid a fight. They don't want to upset the apple cart. So that can be real passivity. And that's inappropriate. So we've got to develop confidence, humility, courage, patience, action energy, all of these combined. So this is where we're understanding the Buddhist approach, making this utter distinction between the neuroses and the virtues. I mean, really technically, profoundly different. It is not the way we think in our culture. It's a very, very interesting way of seeing the mind, you know. So we know the words theoretically when you study low rig. Then you do the real work of putting meat on the bones by seeing your own mind. Becoming intimately familiar with the workings of your own mind. Identifying all these parts. That's being a Buddhist. Then it is easy to help people. Then you can understand how you can have clairvoyance. It is possible when you understand this model. It is easy to see the minds of others. You just hear their words and you can see exactly their delusions. It's not rocket science. But in our culture, we want to understand what their mother did to them before we understand their problem. Oh, that's why she's angry. It's got nothing to do with it. Of course, it's got a lot to do with it. But it's not the point here. Anger is anger is anger. Jealousy is jealousy is jealousy. Love is love is love. When you look at the Buddhist view of the mind, you're not interested in the external events. It's not even relevant. You don't even discuss it. It's not even the point. This is a totally internal job. Totally internal. We have no equivalent in the West. We don't even trust the internal. Psychology is like the lowest, isn't it, of all the sciences. No one trusts it, you know. So subjective. But this is the opposite for the Buddha. And the brilliance and clarity and precision and depth of analysis that we know we need to analyze a brain is exactly what we need to analyze our own mind internally. That's why we have to have concentration. That's why we have to study. I don't know much about the mind, but I did a bit of study a few years ago, a couple of years, you know, maybe. Ever since then, putting meat on the bones. If you just leave it as study, you leave it in your head, and you pass your philosophy exam, it is dead knowledge. That's how we think of knowledge in our culture. We see having knowledge has nothing to do with ethics, has nothing to do with being happy. Whereas for the Buddha, wisdom and happiness and ethics, absolutely integrated. You cannot have one without the other. All got to be put together. That's the Buddha's expertise, you know. So, second verse. Yeah, at least every now and again try and see yourself. Which see yourself as low and now someone as high. Just keep it more simple and make an effort to praise to your own mind. Not to go up to them and tell them. That's just showing off. If a person, especially a person you don't like, whom you find fault in, try and see one good quality about them. Not just a good quality, but one that's better than you. That's the practice of this one. Exactly. That's action for number two. Number three, attempt to grab a delusion before it goes berserk. This is a pretty high practice, I tell you. I mean, this fourth one. Psychopaths are not rarely found. Back in 10th century Tibet, yes. Not now. So this is an outrageous practice. We're overwhelmed by psychopaths, crazies, people who run the countries now, like these maniacs, you know. That's not unusual. There was Hitler before, wasn't there? And Stalin, and your fellow, what was his name, your bloke? What was your bloke, the Italian fella? That one. And there's others as well. There's that other latest one, the B man. Who's he? That one. There are pretty lot of crazies around, aren't they? They all seem to float to the top, don't they? So it's a crazy world. We're living in a crazy world run by psychopaths now. It is not rare at all. This is 1,000 years. This is, look, 1054 the man wrote this. Or he was born then. Like 11th century. This is not 800 years ago. That was rare then. Ain't now. So we've got lots more opportunity to practice now. Think they're most precious. Why? Why is a psychopath precious for you? Because seeing a psychopath is a person who's completely delusional, outrageously negative, harming unbelievable number of sentient beings and harming themselves. So it's forcing you to smash your self-cherishing and your sense of separateness to force you to think this precious person. Precious because they help you grow compassion. That's why they're precious to you. That's the whole point here. People who treat you badly at work, insult you, fire you, accuse you, blame you. Unbearable pain, we know this. Give the victory to them. Try that once a year. Admit the fault. Yeah, you're right, I did do it. You're right. Next one, when your wife leaves you. You've sacrificed your life for her for 40 years, now she's off. With your brother or something. Bye, dear, I'm leaving. Or your daughter. I mean, the number of parents who come to me, or mummies, who say their daughter, their son have rejected them. I can't even bear to hear it. It's so painful, you know. Unbearable. Just unbearable. Well, they're your guru, okay? Just try these things a few times. Why? There's only one reason. Because it'll smash your delusions. And why do you want to smash your delusions? Because you want to be a Buddha, because you want to help others. I mean, that's a pretty high thing to even feel like you want. Most of us just have to say the words and do our best. But when we see actual examples, like Lama Zopa, like His Holiness, actual examples of real bodhisattva behavior, you know, all we can do is aspire. When you realize, I mean, Lama Zopa, because we see, I mean, you know, he's my teacher, that's the way it is. And you see his behavior, never sleeping, never stopping, only ever talking about having compassion for sentient beings. That's all he ever says. That's all he ever talks about. And you know it's genuine for him. You know it's coming from his heart. Genuine. It's hard to bear it. It's too exhausting to think about it, you know. So all we can do is aspire to be this way. But this is what drives these verses. This incredible compassion. It's hard to bear it. It's hard to imagine it. And especially in our culture, because we can't imagine this level of compassion. We can't imagine this stuff without neuroses. It's just not possible. We just can't believe it's possible. So it's hard to imagine it, you know. I remember Kirti Senchab Rinpoche one time saying something like this, some level bodhisattva. Certainly must have been an Arya bodhisattva, someone who's realized emptiness. For this level bodhisattva, the action of cutting off their hand and feeding it to a starving animal is as inconsequential as a leaf falling off a tree. That's insanity, right? That's the level of compassion. That means for sure gone beyond ego, for sure gone beyond attachment and anger, you know, to a profound degree. It's not possible to have that level of compassion without having got rid of that much delusions, you know. I mean, they'd feel the pain, but it's like meaningless. Their compassion is a million times more powerful than their pain. That's the thing to understand. Why we have so much pain now is because we have ego grasping. That's very hard for us to imagine. We believe it's physical. It is physical, but the fear and the panic and the terror is the real pain. Because we have ego grasping. Because we believe in the intrinsic me. It's hard to imagine this. So in brief, this is Tonglen. I'll practice giving my happiness to others, and I'll take upon myself, secretly, in my meditation, all their suffering. Oh. He says respectfully, but Lama Zopa translates as secretly. He says respectfully. How interesting. And then finally, by ensuring that all this... that all, A-L-L, what's this, all chis remains, all this, what's this, A, some funny words there. I have to look it up, Rama Zopa's version. I had it yesterday, didn't I? Where is it? Eight verses. Oh, that's right. Thank you. Okay, undefiled. There it is. Okay, let's just talk about this one now. This is going to be now. We'll get to emptiness now, a little bit. Undefiled by the stains of the superstitions of the eight worldly dharmas. This is a really interesting term, superstitions. Lama would often use it, but it's a really accurate term for affliction. Think about it. Superstition is believing in something that doesn't exist, isn't it? Well, that's exactly the function of all the disturbing emotions. Anger believes in this horrible person there, the whole person, who is causing me suffering. That's the story of anger, and that story is not accurate. There is some truth there, but we over-exaggerate, overstate it, and see it as the absolute truth. That's a superstition. It's a curious way to put it, but that's exactly right. And Lama would often use that phrase. It's a superstition. We believed it for so long. It's absolute truth to us. and very hard to unpack it, to see what isn't true about it, which we need to do more. Of the eight worldly dharmas. This is the way that's presented in the Bodhisattva Path, at this more advanced level of the Bodhisattva Path. And it's just this curious phrase. I don't know where the term eight worldly dharmas come from. Do you ever meet it in all the texts you study in the master's program, Tiziana? Do you ever meet the eight worldly dharmas in some of those Bodhisattva texts? Is it the Tibetans, do you think? Is it the Sanskrit people? Has it ever come up? Very curious, isn't it? Eight worldly dharmas. I wonder what the Tibetan... So who knows? Maybe it's, I don't know if it's the Tibetans or the Indians before them. Because it's like a construct. It's a way of it's a way of presenting attachment at a more primordial level. That's all it is. More primordial level. It's a way of dividing into eight or four pairs, if you like, the way attachment runs everything. So a very simple way we talked about attachment in the first level is at least control attachment to the objects of the senses, at least that. So then we talk about it, anger being the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants, which is a really tasty way to put it. It shows the intimate relationship between attachment and aversion. And we go between those 1,000 times a day. But in the eight worldly dharmas, it presents it differently. It shows how pervasive that it's all attachment. So the first two, and they're saying that these are pervading, these are like the main motivation for mostly, the main motivation, the thing that impels most of our actions. If we're an ordinary person, even if we're a nice person, it's there, polluting, tainting. And the point is about this is quite a subtle analysis. You know, the view of normal in our culture is still a deeply disturbed, mentally ill person as far as Buddha's concerned. It's just a different level of view, that's all. He's more radical in his assessment of mental illness, and he's more radical, therefore, in his assessment of what's possible in terms of getting rid of it. So basically these eight are like, again, a series of assumptions. There's an assumption that happiness is when the good things happen, which is what happiness is, actually. It's true, it is that. We don't question it. So what happens is attachment is constant. Basically, attachment is this constant craving for the nice things to happen, which triggers good feelings. Okay, let's go back to, let's just talk about that. I keep going back to different things, but this is necessary. We'll go back to those verses in a minute, and we're going to break down a bit more here now. Before we even get to this, the eight worldly dharmas, let's go back to this business of what happiness is and what suffering is. This is very excellent to understand. If we say happiness in our world, we actually describe the external event. We're so oriented towards the external, which is the demented, schizophrenic, dualistic way that the misconceptions function. When you talk about, oh, why are you... Tell me about your happiness, Rabina. I will give you in detail all the beautiful qualities of Ron. Won't I? And that will be massive in my mind. The picture of Ron and all his gorgeous things and the beautiful and the this and the things we did and the where we went and what happened and how he held my hand, how he said these words. I'm not being rude now. This is how we think. So for us, happiness means that event. Same with suffering. You describe in detail all the ugly things Ron did. But this is really a misconception. Happiness is a name referring to the mind. The body doesn't experience happiness. Sensory consciousness can, experience feelings. Okay, the word feeling is very fascinating. In the third category of states of mind, it's a way of saying it, you know. I like to call them the mechanics. The stuff that enables us to function. They're neither virtuous nor non-virtuous in their character. Anger is in its character a misconception. Love in its character is a valid concept. Why? It means it's not a misconception. Because why? Because it's in sync with reality. And what's reality? Dependent arising. It's not utterly clear yet until you realize emptiness. There's still a mistake there. But it's relatively valid. But these third lot are like, that's why I say the mechanics is a good word. They enable us to function. So whether you're a murderer or a meditator, you need concentration. There's some of these that are in our mind all the time. So one of these, curiously enough, is called feeling. I don't know what word you use in Italian. Yeah, not like, it's not equivalent to emotion. Completely not emotion, okay? It's like sensation. And in Buddha's analysis of the universe, analysis of minds, of sentient beings, of all the realms, there are only three kinds of feeling. Those that are pleasant. And there's a whole spectrum there. Mildly pleasant to the most intense rapture, bliss, ecstasy. That's called pleasant feeling. And you know another word? Happiness. In the West, when you do all these psychological things, they talk about 40 different levels of happiness. Well, there's one. It's mental. It's the mind experiencing pleasant feelings. Nothing wrong with pleasant feelings. As Lama Yeshe would say, the more pleasure, the better, dear. But we conflate it with attachment. That's our biggest mistake. We think attachment and pleasure are the same. That's why we get guilty and think it's sinful to get good feelings. That's why fundamentalist religious people are like a disaster. Even to think a happy thought is said to be a sin. You know, it's almost like so absurd because we confuse it with attachment. That's a gross mistake. Then you've got unpleasant feelings. Anything from the most mild headache to the most intense pain of torture. And guess what they're called? Suffering. The third lot, don't even worry about them. Indifferent, neutral, forget them. Don't worry about them. So we run out all our, in our lives, think of your day, think of your life. We either have pleasant feelings or we have unpleasant. And guess what? We all want the pleasant and don't want the unpleasant. And that's attachment's job. It's this maniac whose job it is to locate and get, locate, manipulate and control, to get and keep a thing, an event, a sound, a smell, a taste, a person, you name it, that such that when I have contact with it, pleasure is triggered. Look at how hard we have to do to get that. That's the only method we know of how to trigger pleasant feelings. And there's nothing wrong with pleasant feelings. And you know what? All Buddha's saying is, hey, people, I found a method to get pleasant feelings that's free and doesn't depend on stupid old objects. That's all he's telling us. And this is where we understand the second kind of suffering, the suffering of change. It sounds so boring. The suffering of change is the second one. The suffering is the first one. That's when the bad things happen. And speaking bluntly, it's when attachment doesn't get what it wants because it triggers the unpleasant feelings. That's suffering. Now, the second one is more nuanced. It's when attachment gets what it wants. And that is what we call happiness because it implies the method. And that's the only method we know. The only method we know of how to trigger pleasant feelings is to get attachment to get what it wants. That's it. And it's totally tricky, totally manipulative, totally subtle, and will do anything to get what it wants, which is pleasant feelings. So strictly speaking, we think I'm attached to Ron. I'm only attached to Ron as a means to get pleasant feelings. He's just means to an end. Attachment is the most totally manipulative, self-centered junkie in the universe. I don't really even care about Ron. It's only to have contact with him so I can get pleasant feelings. I mean, you know, women go around, we go around accusing men. It's true. I felt like that. Men just, oh, they just want to get you in bed, you know. It's right. That's exactly right. That's what attachment is. So you can get the pleasant feeling. All attachment is like that. Very fascinating. The object is the means to the end. That's how we misuse people and harm them to get what attachment wants, pleasant feelings. That's all, pleasant feelings. But the tragedy, Buddha says, is I'm sorry, you people, it does trigger. So it, you know, getting the cake does trigger a pleasant feeling. A fact, it is a pleasant feeling. Definitely when cake, object, meets tongue, plus the mind with its big story, pleasant feelings are triggered, definite. But Buddha's saying, sorry, people, have you noticed? It doesn't last. And we go, yeah, yeah, we know, like what does last, but we hope it does every time, and we're disappointed every time because we're grasping at it as if it will last. That's why we're also always so devastated when it stops. And all Buddha's saying is, he has found a method of how to get pleasant feelings without depending on attachment, without depending on objects. And they've even discovered that, the Hindus discovered that in single point of concentration. That was their method to get what they call liberation. This in brilliant skill that enables you to go beyond, with much discipline and practice, go beyond the grosser level of your conceptuality and your sensory, go beyond that to the subtle level of mind, and then at that level you will just naturally experience unbelievable, intense bliss. Naturally. It's the natural state of our mind when there are no neuroses there and no gross consciousness. That's it. The Hindus found that. Venerable Rene, our Swiss monk friend, who's a meditator, when I interviewed him in Mandalay, 1995, he said, maybe 2.5 years, I forget now, maybe 1.5, I forget, 2.5 or 1.5 years doing his single point of concentration meditation retreat. And he said he maybe touched upon the fifth of the 9 stages of this technique. And he said there was no question that the joy, I forget his words, the joy I experienced in my mind was so superior to any joy I'd ever experienced through my senses. This is the simple point, so simple that Buddha's making. But we hear it as religion, as giving up, as confused. We're so confused by what Buddha's saying, you know. It's the natural potential of every mind when it's finished with, and this is when you're finished with delusions, when you realize emptiness, you can no longer go back after that. You will only then taste the natural state of your mind, bliss. As Lama Yeshe talks, 11 o'clock, time to have a cup of tea. I'll read you from Lama Yeshe later. Lama's so sweet, he'd always encourage us. If you read the text, like Pabongka, he gives you all the technical steps in the 9 stages. It's very technical. Lama gives us a few experiences to get us excited, you know. So I'll read you later, after tea break. So conclusion here. Feeling, in the 3rd category, is simply neither a virtuous nor a non-virtuous state of mind. It's simply a natural part of mind. It's like one of the mechanics, call it that. And we only have pleasant or unpleasant. Forget the neutral. We have either pleasant or unpleasant. And attachment's job, the maniac in the first level, its job is to get the object. So it's the only way we know how to trigger pleasure. We might just lie there and think things. We can trigger pleasure by having fantasies. We can trigger pleasure, you know, we can get pleasure from doing good things. We do that. But in general, having this body made of the senses, a sensory body, which is the product of countless lives of attachment. The only method we have, generally, is to get access to an attachment object, which then indeed does trigger some pleasure. But we know, to finish this now, we know it doesn't last. But it's hard to hear that because we don't know what the alternative is. Buddha gives us that. So it doesn't last. This is the part of the first things to understand, which is what we call happiness. It's what we call happiness, which is pleasant feelings, is what we get when we get what attachment wants. That's our method. That's the method of the junkie. That's samsara. But then we know it doesn't last. But we know that, what we don't see is that we're frantically kind of hoping it will last. Certainly when it comes to relationships. We'll discuss this later. And then we're always devastated when it doesn't. And it doesn't because it's not possible. And that we have to understand technically. So even just the cake is obvious. It's so obvious. It was so obvious we can't see it. We know the first mouthful triggers the best pleasure. It's downhill from there. And this is the point about dissatisfaction. You have that first mouthful, and it definitely triggers really pleasant feelings. But even as we're chewing it, we're already dissatisfied and are hungrily expecting the second mouthful. I remember reading about one guy who was attached to sex, talking about when he's having sex with one girl, he was already anticipating the next one. A friend of mine who had seven children, when she gave birth to her sixth, she's in the bed in the hospital, and the woman next to her in the bed is giving her baby milk. And already she'd just given birth, this friend, to her sixth baby, and she's already craving a seventh. That's how attachment works. One of its functions is to always anticipate more, never satisfied with this. So that's how we know that. So you're all excited with this delicious taste, but hungrily wanting the second piece, and then anticipating more pleasure. But we know if we analyze the pleasures now going downhill, and you keep eating cake, and we know the result. As we're eating it, the cake that looked so divine before through the lenses of attachment gradually changes into something disgusting. So attachment turns into aversion. And the cake will now look revolting, and now you will feel disgusting. And if you ate another mouthful, you'd vomit. So this is what he means by it, the suffering of change. What we call happiness is true. But we keep having that object, hoping for more happiness, but all we end up getting is the suffering of suffering. But the next day, what do we remember? We forget that it was indigestion. We forget the acid reflux. We forget the burping. We forget all of that. We only remember that moment of pleasure and hope to have it again and eat it again and hope this time it'll work. That's how attachment works. We understand it. We see it. We recognize it. This is scientific. This is not religion. So, having the senses, having attachment, having the karma, being programmed in this, the only way we know how to trigger pleasant feelings is to get the object. So, in other words, what we think happiness is what we get when we get what attachment wants. Buddha says, no, 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 babies. No, 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 sweethearts. It's easier than that. Happiness is what you get when you give up attachment. That's all he's saying. That's all he's saying. Of course, it's hard work. When we know it and have confidence in it, we will try. It's hugely difficult. It's giving up being a junkie. It is not easy. No one says it is, but it's logical and doable. So have a cup of tea. We'll see you later.
Or a cup of coffee, or a...